Meeting. I'm happy to see the big turnout here. Before we get started, I would ask everyone to stand for the Pledge of Allegiance, please.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
And really quick, before we get started into the meeting, as a lot of you probably know, Jim Monroe, who was the manager of the Moose here for years, unfortunately passed away recently. Jim was a great supporter of the lake and the community. So as the board, we want to express our condolences to his family. As many of you know, Brian, his son, is a member of the Lake Improvement Association board. So I would just ask everybody to take a moment, for a moment of silence in Jim's memory. All right, thank you. We'll start with the financial report with Ted Berkey.
Good morning. You'll have people celebrating or reviewing all the fundraisers that we've been involved in, but just for your information, right now the checkbook is $73,311. And the foundation, which we use to pay our bills without paying sales tax because they're a charitable organization, the foundation is at $19,000. Some of the things that we've put allocated money to in the last month, we purchased some cement corn holes so they can't be moved once they're seated in a position at the park. You're going to have to get a crane to move them. Grand Lake Crappie sponsor for $500. Lake Festival sponsor for $4,000. Veterans Forever, a new function, $5,000. And then boards for replacing boards on the tables, the picnic tables at the park, $1,800. Questions? Thank you.
Thanks, Ted. After the meeting, if you have a chance going on this weekend, today and tomorrow is the Grand Lake Boat Show. That's at the Boathouse at Grand Lake, Lakeshore Marina, Baby Marina, Cozy Marina, and the Outdoorsman. I know they'll have lots of neat boats out for you to check out. Buy where you boat. And speaking of boats, our pontoon raffle is going well. The Boathouse at Grand Lake has donated a boat to raise funds for lake improvement efforts. So far we've sold over 200 tickets of the 500 available. They're 100 each, so each ticket gets you a 1 in 500 chance to win. You can get those online at lakeimprovement.com or from us here today or at the Boathouse or at a Boardwalk Grill. Just gonna give some updates on some of what we've been up to as the board, and then we'll get into our speakers. The West Bank Playground and Shelter. The playground is fully funded. As you know, right now we're working on the shelter house. The total cost on the shelter house is around $43,000. Last year, Cargill donated $6,641. And this year so far, the Salina Lions Club has committed $5,000 toward this project. The Mercer County Sportsmen's Association has committed $500. That leaves us a balance of around $30,858 for raising funds for. So it's really nice to see all these community partners, as you can see up there, supporting this project. The All Abilities Playground that's going in on the East Bank has been ordered. We ordered this main core component, and then here's another view that shows the swings. I believe right now we're just waiting for that to come in, and then we'll figure out the installation date for that. Real quick, I'd like to ask Jeff Vossler to come up and give us a quick overview of the Winter Icebreaker dance we had a couple weeks ago.
All Thanks, Brian. I see a few familiar faces who made it to the event. I'm thinking everyone had a good time. I see some of the hats out there. It was crazy. Probably over 400 people was at the event. 19 corporate tables, I think 15 group tables. And I think we had a great time with that. We were able to make about $12,000 off the event. So again, appreciate all the support from people who provided silent auction items to us and helped work the event. And then for all the people who came and helped sponsor us. So appreciate everybody coming out. And I get online and look at our photos. Dave Shaner put out over 600 photos of our event, and people had a very good time, you know, with that. So put that on your calendar for next year. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff. Just a quick note on our membership. Next month, or really this month in March, we'll start getting everything around to get membership cards out the door. So if you've already joined or renewed, you should get that in the mail probably around the beginning to mid-April. If you haven't joined and renewed, I would encourage you to consider doing that. We have flyers at all the tables that just give a brief overview of what the LIA does and what your support goes toward funding. And you can scan the QR code to go to our website and learn more. I know the last couple of meetings we've talked about the Prairie Creek funding we received, originally $2.6 million to fix the berm at Prairie Creek. That's been elevated to $5.3 million, which will leave some funds for some work that's needed for Coldwater Creek. The state is working with an engineering firm on preliminary investigations for that, so we'll keep you posted. Something else we wanted to mention, if you're not familiar, the Ohio Department of Health maintains a beach guard application on its website, and the idea is to provide a way for the public to see which recreational beaches around the state are under a water quality advisory. It's a good service to educate Ohioans on, you know, lake safety, but there are a couple of issues that we recently noticed, or the LRC recently noticed. One is when you open up the application, what you see is it's zoomed in on our lake here, not the entire state. And another issue is that it shows advisories at our lake right now, which we're not under advisory. So as I understand it, basically the testing window is from Memorial Day to Labor Day, and they take that last reading and it carries out through the rest of the year. But there are other areas around the lake, for example, or the state, for example, Maumee Bay, that got readings later into the year. So they're not showing their lake being under advisory up there right now, and we are, which is not accurate. So Lake Restoration Commission is working on setting up a meeting with the lake directors to talk about this, because we want to be transparent, we want to make sure the data is accurate, and we want fair and equal treatment with the other areas around the state. So again, we'll keep you updated on that. Another project that we're in discussions on, and we're just in an exploratory stage right now, so we don't have a lot of details, but we're in discussions on adding a bike and walking path that would connect the campground area on the east side over to East Bank. And the hope is to make that basically come up and go along the shore. So it will give our visitors and our community a nice, safe area to be able to walk, ride their bikes, whatever, right along the lake there. That's something that I know has been requested for a long time, and I think this is something that's going to get a lot of community support. But again, right now we're just investigating that. I think the next step is to try to get some engineering to see what that's going to take, and then figure out what the cost will be and go from there. So again, we'll keep you updated on that. Some recent board actions. As you know, part of what we do is support events that bring people into the lake and help spur our local economy. So some things, and Ted mentioned this briefly, some of the things that we've done as a board recently, the Governor's Cup Regatta is coming back to the lake this year on June 21st and 22nd. So we've voted to donate $5,000 toward this event. You can learn more on their website at governorscupregatta.com. Salina Lake Festival, the LIA supports us every year. This year, We're donating $4,000 to sponsor the fireworks at the event. As you know, that's a massive event on the lake that brings a lot of people in and gets a lot of local dollars spent here. You can learn more about that at SalinaLakeFest.com. We also donated $500 to the Grand Lake Crappie Series. And on May 16th and 17th, we'll have a booth at the Boardwalk Boat and Bike Show. The last couple of years, we've had like a cornhole tournament there and a 50-foot cornhole toss. I'm not sure if we'll do the same thing this year, but again, that's another neat event that happens on the lake that we'll be supporting. That's also where we'll be drawing the pontoon raffle winner. You don't have to be present for that, but I would encourage you to be because it's really a fun time there on the West Bank. Just a heads up, Saturday, April 19th is Lake Cleanup Day. We'll have information on our website about this pretty soon. Last year, a group of students from Wright State University, they came out, and if anyone remembers, that was a really cold, really windy day. And that group of students asked, well, where's the spot on the lake that, you know, kind of gets missed during cleanup day? So I asked State Park Manager David Fahler, and he said, Anderson's gets overlooked. So these kids went out there, and they got in the water, and they got in the muck, and they pulled a ton of trash out. So that was really neat for me to see the students get that involved and volunteer for that effort. This year the St. Mary's Rotary has already reached out and asked how they could help. So I think we're getting more support on that day, more volunteers out there today to help us keep our lake beautiful. And then I just heard about this. I don't know a lot about this. I'm trying to see the date, May 30th and 31st. There's a boat racing experience that's going to happen out here on the lake. And if I'm reading it right, it sounds like you can pay to get in a boat with a racer and race it around the lake. So if that's something you're interested in, we'll get this information on our website in the next week or so. Like I said, it's the end of May, so you have a little bit of time. But if, you know, if you've got the need for speed, you might want to check that out. Next, I'd like to invite a special guest to the podium. This is ODNR Wetland Habitat Coordinator Dave Sherman, and he has some exciting news to share with us.
Morning, y'all. Said, I'm Dave Sherman, Wetland Habitat Coordinator for the Division of Wildlife. So what that means is I oversee all our wetland projects that are done on public land on division property. And before H2 Ohio occurred, I actually had a different job. Now half my job is doing H2 Ohio wetlands, which is pretty cool. We can go throughout the state and help. I oversee, manage the project, work with all kinds of collaborators, and I've done 37 projects so far out of the 200 that's been put on the land. And I must say, some of the collaborators are just a real piece of work. But unfortunately, that is not the case here in Mercer. Sean Finke and I have worked with the Mercer Soil and Water, specifically Teresa here, for the past, I don't know, 5 or 7 years. And she is a rock star. If I had other collaborators like her, I could just sit around and watch Judge Judy all day because I wouldn't have anything to do. The collaborator is responsible for on the ground overseeing the activities. They hire the contractor, make sure they're doing the work, they pay the bills, they send out the requests for qualifications, they do everything. And when it goes well, I get the credit. When it goes bad, I try to defer to them. But so the director is not, I'm not on her Christmas card list anymore because I only have one Teresa Dirksen and a whole bunch of other people who are not as well qualified. So the Division of Wildlife presents Wildlife Awards. So Teresa, if you want to come up to basically to honor her work, Sean Finke and I nominated her for this. So you guys got a rock star living amongst you.
I had no idea.
You're welcome.
Want me to stay up here?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Congratulations, Teresa. Really appreciate everything you're doing for our lake. Understate the impact you've had. And with that, I will leave the podium for Teresa to give her Ag and Natural Resources update.
Thank you. I had no idea. You guys shocked the crap out of me this morning, so thank you. I appreciate it. So those of you that don't know me, I am the Ag and Natural Resources Director for Mercer County. I've been here working on Grand Lake issues for almost 19 years. It's hard to believe. Started with the Conservation District in 2006, got my professional engineering license in 2009, and then kind of switched roles in 2016, became the Ag Solutions Coordinator directly under the commissioners, and that's morphed into my role now as the Ag and Natural Resources Director. I do facilitate the Lake Restoration Commission, so I organize everything for that group and work on their projects as well. So it's really fun, and I love Grand Lake, and I hope by the time that I retire in 13-ish years that, you know, it's no longer a distressed watershed. We no longer have recreational advisories, so that's my ultimate goal, is to reach that hopefully in the next 13 years. It's great to have a big crowd here, and I know you probably can't really see this all that well, but I want to promote the fact that we have these natural spaces around Grand Lake St. Mary's. I know we try to spread the word, but it seems like it's hard to get the message out there that we have all of these natural spaces that are open to the public. They're beautiful. There's walking trails on almost every single one of them. And I would encourage the public to get out and enjoy nature, especially if you don't have access to that. It's a great opportunity. These sites are open year round from sunrise to sunset, and they all are unique. So I want to just kind of point out some of these projects, and I don't know how many, is everybody familiar with our natural sites?
No?
Great. I'm glad that y'all are here today. So like I said, I know it's hard to see, but our flagship treatment train, which is essentially a treatment wetland, was on Prairie Creek. It's a 30-acre site. We pump water from the lake for treatment through a series of constructed wetlands, goes out into the littoral wetland. Coldwater Creek was our second site over here. That was constructed in 2015. Again, beautiful. I think it's about close to a mile walking path around the site. I know people that live close to it utilize it every day. It's another beautiful site. Beaver Creek was our third site. That one sits real close to the Montezuma Club Island wastewater treatment plant. Here, down here is a project that's near and dear to my heart. It's on the Mercer County Elks Golf Course, so it's not open to the public, but if you're a golfer or a member, I'm sure you've seen it. It's a natural channel restoration. We did that project back in 2019 and 2020. The stream meanders now. It's about 2,000 feet. It's, instead of it being a straight channelized sloughing banks, it's a beautiful restoration. I get excited. We go out every year and take a look at it in the summer, and every year it looks better and better. It's one of my proudest projects, I will say. We've got Windy Point over here, a small wetland. We've got Gilliland Nature Preserve. The Franklin Township owns 80 acres of natural space. We developed a 2-acre wetland across the road from that area back in 2020. It's another beautiful little site that has a small walking trail. Another great project that I personally love, our first H2 Ohio project here at Burntwood Langenkamp. That's got a 1-mile walking path. It's on 90 acres. It's just off Coldwater Creek Road. One of my very favorite sites to see. I would highly encourage you June and July when wildflowers peak. It's absolutely breathtaking. There is an observation tower, observation deck, interpretive signage. It's phenomenal. And then several other sites across the lake. So I encourage you to get out and take a look at those. If you ever want more information, I'm happy to share more information with you in the future. These are some of our newest projects that just got established that we plan to open to the public this year by establishing those walking paths and getting our signage up. Each of them does have a small little parking area, and they're just getting going with the vegetation because all three of these, or four of these, were constructed last year. North Shore Green Space, which is just off of Wright State Lake Campus. Rosenbeck Nature Preserve sits off of Fleetfoot Road, just north of 219 by the Village of Coldwater. And Southwest Green Space, formerly known as the Old South Bay Motel project, and Little Chickasaw Creek. This is Little Chickasaw Creek from the air. We did a stream restoration project out there. Little Chickasaw Creek used to go straight into Grand Lake, and now it's about a 2,500 lineal meandering creek with wetlands attached. We're planning a wetland tour at this site with a wildflower identification event on July 19th of this year. It'll probably start in the morning, so mark your calendars for that. Hopefully we can not only visit this site, but maybe visit a few other sites around the lake as well. So what's coming up for 2025? This is going to be one of our newest sites. This sits in Auglaize County, just off of State Route 703. This is called the Red Wing Nature Preserve. It adjoins the state park campground, and we acquired about 16 and a half acres there. We're going to develop 5 acres of new wetland on the project, or on the site, and then plant native plants, wetland plants, grasses, forbs, and we're excited to get that one moving forward. We will be treating lake water, pumping lake water into this wetland for treatment. Another thing we're working on, I just submitted a 319 grant application to install an additional pump station. This is our Beaver Creek vegetated biofilter. It's our treatment wetland on Beaver Creek. You can see this is the ponds at the wastewater treatment plant. But what we're proposing is to add another lift station here so we can double the capacity. Our existing pump station that was installed in 2018 can pump 500,000 to 600,000 gallons. We can double that because the site has the capacity. And hopefully that application will be accepted and we'll be able to move forward. It kind of depends on where federal funding lands, because we all know that everything's kind of frozen right now in the federal government. So we'll see how that progresses. Just wanted to touch on the toxin data. Stephen Jackman shares this with me every week. This comes from the city of Salina's intake data. So as you can see, we're sitting around zero for toxin levels, you know, 1 to 0 this time of year. So what I want to point out is, you know, the black line is our historical average. So once we hit a new year, the past year gets factored into that historical average. And as we keep coming down in toxin trends, this historical average keeps coming down. So we're happy to see that we're below that. And last year, we only rose above the World Health Organization a few weeks of the year. So we want to keep that trend going and see how we progress. I know Stephen had mentioned at our Lake Restoration Commission meeting that we did have very heavy ice cover this year. So the spring rains will be telling on how the lake behaves this year. If we don't have a lot of spring rain, it could be interesting. We'll probably see a lot of clarity in the lake going into May and June. But if we get a lot of spring rain, it'll probably be a typical year here at Grand Lake St. Mary's. I wanted to mention Solon Water. So I am the Solon Water's engineer as well. They have a tree seedling sale going on. I think the deadline to order is March 9th. Trees will be coming in on April 8th. These are all bare root seedlings, so they're not large, but pretty good pricing and a great way to support the soil and water and get out there and plant some trees. They have a yellow raspberry, which was pretty popular last year. I've heard they're actually pretty good and they grow pretty well. So if you are interested in this, I know they're having issues with website. I would suggest reaching out via email and we can get you an order form or stop up at the office at on Mud Pike. They also have a fish sale for your ponds going on. This deadline to order is April 12th and fish pickup will be on April 25th. So feel free to order fish as well if you've got a pond and need to stock that. With that, I'll take any questions. Any? None? Yes?
For the fish ordering, that has to be, you have to be a resident of Mercer County?
Nope, you don't have to be. I know other county soil and waters do some fish sales. Just depends on who you'd like to support, and, you know. So you don't have to be a resident. Yes?
What does the ice cover have? What effect does that have on the...
So when you get really heavy ice cover, it knocks the biomass down,
okay,
like a lot, because you can't, there's just no activity happening in the lake. So heavy ice cover is a good thing, but the way Stephen explains it is, you know, the mixing that happens in the spring will bring about the type of algae that we're gonna see. If you remember back in 2021, we had extreme clarity in the water until about mid-June. And then we saw blooms of Phanazominon and Microcystis, which is not what we typically see. Typically, we have Planktothrix in our lake, which gives it that green color all the way through. Phanazominon and Microcystis likes to sit on the top as scum, and it turns those really bright green and blue colors. So 2021 wasn't terrible. It was very isolated and it moved really quickly. And then it kind of, all those species died back and then we were back to Planktothrix. So that's what we would expect to see possibly if we don't have a lot of spring rain, is that extreme clarity in the lake until about mid-June. And then when you get those warmer temperatures, you get the sunlight penetration to the bottom, that's when you start to see the blooms, okay? Yes.
I understand that the fish at the hatchery, the fingerlings, that they don't really go into Grand Lake, they go other places. Why is that?
I can't answer that. I don't know if any of the wildlife guys in the room can answer that.
Some of the fish do come to Grand Lake, but the hatchery produces fish for all over the state.
Okay. Yes.
Do you have any kind of brochure on like the nature trails where somebody could check that out?
Yeah, I do have a map that I've generated that shows where they're all located and the walking path mileage for each site. I'm happy to share that via email. Just shoot me an email and I'll send it to you.
Could you put that on the Lake Improvement website?
Yeah, I think it's been posted before.
Well, sure, if you could resend it to me, I'll make
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, I'm well. Okay.
I know that's either done or it's in work.
Yep. Yeah.
Question,
I'm not real good at map making. Like, I'm good at AutoCAD, but I am not good at pretty renderings. So we need somebody else to take the data and make it pretty. So, yes.
Do you have a total number of acres of wetland that they've created in the last 20 years?
Yes. So if you include the littoral wetlands, so we've got 250 acres in Lake Wetland at Coldwater Creek and 100 at Prairie Creek. Including those, we've developed about 1,000 acres of new wetlands in the last 12 years. So.
Versus how many acres in the prior 50 years?
Well, if you look at the historical data, I think 2006, the wetland inventory showed that about less than 0.5% of the watershed was wetlands. We've brought that back up to 2% in the last 10 year or 12 years. So we've really made some strides on bringing wetlands back. Stephen did a research paper. It's available. I don't know if it's available online, but I know it's been published, where it looks at the historical data of how many wetlands we used to have before settling here, and then the loss, and then kind of our rebound back. All right, I guess we'll move on. And thanks again. I appreciate the recognition.
Thank you, Teresa. Next, I'd like to ask State Park Manager David Fahler to give us an update on the state park.
Good morning. So the gentleman over here, I don't know if you heard his question, he asked about the fish that are produced at the St. Mary's Fish Hatchery, and he had heard that none of the fish that they produce go into Grand Lake. I do know that they do produce fish for the entire state, and they do produce fish for Grand Lake as well. Historically, they have brought fish from the hatchery, mainly yellow perch. So they've been stalking them for several years now, and we're starting to see quite a few yellow perch being caught, 6 to 12 inch range. So they're doing a good job. They are going to be stalking some triploid sawguy again this year. So we'll see how that works out. As we've seen before, it works real well. The sawguy love Grand Lake. They have plenty of feeder fish for them. So good morning. I would like to do a moment of silence as well. We had Assistant Park Manager Ron Piles. He was in charge of our dredge program for many years and part of our maintenance program for many years. He passed on Monday, and he will be missed. He fought cancer for about 15 years, and he's now resting. So if you just a moment of silence, please. Thank you. So lake level on Monday was -4.25 inches. I can't give you a lake level reading today. It's just way too windy. It would not be accurate. Rain so far for February was 1.51 inches, and for January it was 0.99. So far for 2024, we've gotten 2.5 inches of rain. Keep in mind, this is very low for this time of year. Hopefully it's not an indication of what we've seen the past 2 years. There was no drawdown for 24-25 because the lake was below that -9 inches. We have two 5K hikes on the canal, March 9th and April 1st, I'm sorry. And those will be at the St. Mary's Township Hall. Memorial Day, some camp updates. Memorial Day weekend is full. The second week and the third week of June are full. The fourth week, we have 6 sites open. 4th of July weekend, we are full. The second weekend, we have 12 sites open. The third weekend, we have 3 sites. Fourth weekend, we have 21 sites. Labor Day weekend, we have 3 electric campsites available only. And Fall Festival is September 5th and 7th. So if you want to put that on your calendars, as always, it's open to the public, and we'd love to see people come out. Last year, we doubled the size of it. We're going to keep it the same size. We're bringing in many of the same vendors. We've got some new food vendors that we're working on. And again, this year, we're going to have a couple of the marinas and golf cart companies around the lake there as well. Halloween camp out is October 3rd through 5th this year. The state dock invoices were sent out, as well as the private dock invoices. State docks holders are due March 31st. Private docks are due on April 30th. So 2025 is going to be the year of capital improvements in the park. As long as I've been here, I've never seen as much capital money that's being put into the park and to Grand Lake as what I'm seeing this year. So we have, and with the park, I also manage the Miami Erie Canal, so I consider that part of it. Of course, the lake was built for the canal, so. Lock 23 and Dolphus is currently being replaced. Yale Spillway Gate and Bridge is going to be replaced. December of 2025, construction of a new office and camp store is slated to begin. We're also replacing a 20 in the fall of 2025 and winter of 2026. They're going to be replacing a 5-foot corrugated steel pipe. So when you come into West or East Bank and you cross over the water, that right there. So when that's being replaced, that will East Bank will be completely shut off. We won't have any access to it. But that's a big project, and it's great to see that happening. And one of the biggest ones for lake health is our littoral wetlands. So Angie King got us $2.6 million, Representative Angie King, for getting work done on the littoral wetland, mainly Prairie Creek. ODNR has decided that this is a very important project, and as Jeff had mentioned, or no, Brian had mentioned, it's been increased to $5.3 million. So that's in the works, and we're starting to do the engineering on that project too. That's all I have today. Does anybody have any questions? Good, thank you.
Thank you, Dave. Next, I'd like to invite Dr. Chuck Sampaglio to the podium. Dr. Sampaglio is a professor of earth science and paleobiology at Wright State University Link campus, and is here to take us on a trip through time in West Central Ohio. Please join me in giving Dr. Sampaglio a warm welcome.
Thank you. Is that my clicker?
Yeah.
Well, it's good to be here this morning, and it's the first time I've actually been to the Moose, so nice to see that this association is so large. You guys are interested in the lake. That's great. We're going to do something a little bit different here. Of course, we're going to start to step back in time. I'm going to bring you forward Dan, who is my lab assistant and my graduate student who's working on his PhD, is passing around a geologic time column. I figured it would be nice just so you had a reference in front of you, because I'm going to be throwing out some dates and ages, and if you haven't had any kind of formal geology, it might be a little confusing, and I don't want to do that. So, but I do want to take us through a little trip through time here and show you how varied the life and geology of this area is. I mean, it's truly mind-boggling when you take a look at it going back. So, what's that? Okay, can you hear me better now?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Okay, so the geologic history of our area, and I mean Ohio in particular, but definitely our area, is really rich and varied. In our counties, if we go to the quarries and river valleys, we get into the Silurian period, which is over 400 million years old, okay? And then, as we come back up into the soil, into the actual land that we walk on, a lot of that is Pleistocene age from the ice ages. So we have a 400 million year gap here, but I'm going to try to fill in some of that gap. If you go to the south, and if you've, you know, when you drive down to Dayton or Cincinnati and you look on the sides of the road, you'll see very large road cuts. That is late Ordovician in age, about 450 million years old. And the fossils and sediments are so well preserved that it brings people from all over the world, not only to do research, but also to collect. Okay. If you go to the north, up in Van Wert and Paulding counties, we get into incredible Middle Devonian strata and fossils. Again, places where People will come from all over just to collect the fossils. It's just amazing preservation, okay? So, and you all probably know this, in our fields and streams, river banks, you can find place to see mammal remains. It's probably about every few months somebody has a picture of something they found and want to know if it was Bessie the cow or was it a mammoth or something like that. So sometimes it is Bessie and sometimes it is actually a mammoth or a mastodon. So I think this is a really interesting thing because the Grand Lake area was once the most productive and richest oil and gas field in the world. It didn't last for long, but for about 20 years, we produced most of the natural gas and oil that fed our kind of industrial revolution. So, interesting. Well, being a professor, I have to give you a few little lessons, right? But I'll make them as easy as I can, okay? Just because we're gonna talk about things moving around. And so an understanding of the Earth is pretty good. I think most people realize we have a core and a mantle and crust. And this is a simplified view, but the core, the inner and outer core are very hot. And especially the outer core, it causes convection and conduction and movement of the mantle itself, which then moves the crust around. And the crust is fractured into plates. We call them tectonic plates. And every time you hear about earthquakes or volcanoes, we're usually talking about the interaction of these plates. So the Earth is very, very dynamic. And part of that reason is because the Earth is really a water planet. And the water actually aids the tectonics, okay? I like to show this slide to say, what is a continent, right? Well, our continent has a few of these things called cratons, okay? And these are the primitive crust of the Earth, the really old stuff, the stuff going back sometimes 3 to 4 billion years old. And that's the core of our continent. But, if we're like in Africa or South America, there could be three cratons altogether. Those things have come together to make what we call the present day continents, like South America, Asia, North America. So we live smack dab in the craton right here, okay? We're actually on the continental platform. That's where the sediments collect. So our sediments are at least 1,000 feet thick or more before you would ever hit that hard rock. Now, if we would go up to Wisconsin, Michigan, Minnesota, we could actually see the continental shield. That ancient part is exposed, okay? So we're in the solid part of the continent here, okay? But to the east and to the west, especially to the coast, we get into the parts that interact with the tectonic plates, and that's where we see primarily our mountain building, and then past the mountains, we get into the coastal plains, and then the continental shelf, and then the ocean. Now, we're on dry land right now, but this is not always the case. And you got to understand that, this is not a constant thing. Eventually, this continent will become part of another continent. But the thing that's interesting is the cratons tend to stay together. So one day, North America won't look like it is, but this piece that we're on, which is huge, will just be a part of another landmass. Okay? I don't know how much about plate tectonics you've heard, but these plates interact with each other. Sometimes one goes below another, and this is called subduction, and this brings continents together. And when continents come together, they collide and form huge mountains. Also, as those plates dive down, they melt and throw up magma, which produces volcanoes. If we get out to the mid-ocean, we have an area where all around the Earth, it looks like the stitching of a baseball, the plates are actually spreading apart. And it's a good thing, because that's how plate tectonic works. But if you keep spreading, the Earth would get larger, which we know it does not, so we actually recycle that crust at the subduction zones. And so that's where we're gonna see lots of volcanic activity, and we're also gonna see a lot of earthquake origins. The third type of interaction is when the plates move side by side. Okay, and these are called transform fault boundaries. A classic example is in California. The San Andreas is a system of faults where the North American plate is moving to the southeast and the southwest, and the Pacific plate is moving to the northeast. So one day, LA and San Francisco will be together. It won't be good, but they'll be together. Okay. Now, a little bit about geologic time. Hopefully everybody's got a chart in front of them. MA means millions of years ago, GA means billions of years ago, but here's the cool thing. If we take a look at those things called eras, Ohio has most of the Paleozoic era exposed in rocks, except for the Cambrian, which is at the very bottom, and just a teeny tiny bit of Permian in the southeast. Okay, the rest of the state, if you go to different places, actually has those rocks of those ages exposed. Now, the rocks under our feet, again, are Silurian. So that gives you kind of an estimate of around 400, 420 million years old. And then there's a vast jump into what we get into the Pleistocene epoch, which is the Ice Ages. Okay? So everybody says, well, where are the dinosaurs? Well, dinosaurs did walk around in Ohio, but they didn't leave their fossils behind because Ohio at that point was above sea level. And any rivers or sediments that were collected that could have fossilized those things have been either filled in by glacial sediments or wiped away by erosion. So we don't get, if you want to consider that exciting, we don't get that. I don't consider the dinosaurs as exciting as some of the gigantic fish that actually lived in Ohio. So I think that's pretty cool. For example, Cleveland area has some of the best known earliest fish, sharks, placoderms. It's incredible preservation, right? So we'll just kind of touch on that a little bit. But so everybody sees that, you know, geologic time, we start at 4.5 billion years ago, go to the present, we divide it up into pieces for reference. Those are not arbitrary pieces. Those are actually based on erosional boundaries typically. And by that, I mean big events where sometimes the oceans rise and flood the cratons. And so there's been at least three times where Ohio's been underwater, all right? So if we're gonna begin our journey, we gotta go back not 200 million years, not 12,000, not even 400 million, but 1.2 billion years ago. And it, around that time, let's see, does this laser work? Yeah, around that time, this is most of what we call that craton, that North American craton we call Laurentia. Each of these different colored pieces was a protocontinent that got sutured together to form our craton. So piece by piece, it built up North America. And if you notice, there's something kind of interesting right here. You see this thing that says 1.1? That's 1.1 billion years ago. The North American continent started to fracture into pieces and would have continued to fracture except for there was another protocontinent to the east that came and slammed into North America and sealed it all up. And that is called the Grenville Province. And why do I bring this up? Because you can see, first off, the Grenville Province forms the east coast of North America. Secondly, we're standing on the edge of the Grenville Province right now. So we have a suture line between the primitive North America and the Grenville Province that came together, sealed up North America, and finished building what we know today as North America. Now, because that is a suture line, it's like a scar, okay? You know, if you have a scar and it heals, everything's cool until you bump it, and then it hurts again, right? So that scar never totally heals. And so we're right on that boundary, and this gives us our seismic activity that we have in this area, okay? So you know that if we look at in last 200 years, 150 years, there's been a fair number of earthquakes in Ohio. I mean, nothing above a 6, but some in the 5 range on the Richter scale. And you gotta remember, every time you bump up one number, that's 10 times stronger. So if you go from a 4 to a 5, that means that earthquake is 10 times stronger. And notice that we have some really biggies up there near Cleveland and right around here, right here smack dab where we live, and that's that Grenville fault front line. And here you can actually see where the front is. So this is the old part of North America, and this is the younger part of North America, and we're right on that edge. Of course, every once in a while, we get some pretty decent earthquakes. This is from the 1937 Anna earthquake, which literally brought some buildings down, destroyed the insides of houses, cracked chimneys, really caused a lot of damage. I don't think we've had anything quite that strong since then, but we've had some 4s, some 4.5s. Now, thing is, our suture line, right, is actually attached to other suture lines. So have anybody ever heard of the New Madrid Fault? And that's in Missouri, right? On the border of Missouri, Kentucky, and Tennessee, kind of like that weird little bubble all the way down there. That thing is very, very active. If you go to the USGS and look at earthquakes by the day, you'll see there's always activity around the New Madrid. In the early 1800s, it let loose to almost a magnitude 10, which is one of the largest we've ever known. Now, there wasn't much built up in the Midwest at that time, because this is around 1810, 1811. But eyewitness reports actually say that cattle were thrown in the air by the waves that went across the land. It was so powerful an earthquake that church bells in New England and Canada were ringing. Now, if that ever goes off, that's going to actually trigger our Grenville Front Fault. So that's something that, you know, we'd probably get a decent sized earthquake then. So, but not to scare anybody. Doubt it'll happen. Probably happen eventually. I mean, you can't build mountains without earthquakes. I mean, that's the thing, right? Just to show, too, that if we take a look over the last 550 million years in North America, there have been at least six times where sea levels have risen and covered the center of the continent. For Ohio, that's happened three times. And we give these things names where the sediments are really indicative of the sea level rise. And we'll take a look at that in a minute. Notice that the sea levels are particularly high here from around 550 to around 300 million years ago. And then the sea levels fall for quite a while. That's during the time of the great supercontinent called Pangaea. So as the continents start to break up and move, that actually causes rifting in the ocean floor. And that rifting causes the ocean floor to buckle upwards and makes the water spill onto the land. Then as the continents stop moving rapidly, the sea levels come back down. Now, there's been a super cycle like you see there, but there's also been other cycles on top of it. So here you can see that this thing called the Tippecanoe sequence, the Kaskaskia and the Absaroka, these are all parts of the times that Ohio was underwater. Okay? So at least three times during that Paleozoic. One other thing to keep in mind is that as continents collide, as pieces come together, you have to think of it as like, okay, if a car is going 50 miles an hour, 60 miles an hour, and slams into a wall, you get a lot of damage right in the front, right? But even the back now is warped, right? It's out of a line, the frame is twisted, and that's what happens to our continent. Every time there's one of these big collisions, pieces buckle or fold downward and give the continent kind of a dimpled appearance. Now, we happen to live on what's called the Cincinnati Arch. Literally, it's a topography that starts around Tennessee and goes like this, and then all the way down to Canada. So, at the top of the arch, sediments erode away much faster than they do at the bottom of the arch. So, we live on the part where the sediments erode very quickly and expose the older stuff. That's why we have those really old fossils in the area. And this shows the tri-state area, and as you notice, see this light pink? This is the oldest sediments. And so right up around here is where we live. This purple is the Silurian. So that's what we would see if we could strip all the soil off, we'd be into the Silurian strata in our area. Notice as you go to the north and as you go to the south, the east and the west, the sediments become much younger. That's because they're not eroding away faster. We live on the arch, and the arch has provided us with an exposure into the past. All right, so let us start our little journey here. So this is the late Ordovician around 450 million years ago. The circle is that tri-state area I showed you. We're right in that circle. Notice we're under the water, okay? Got land to the east and north, a little tiny bit to the west, and there is no west coast of North America as we think of it today. If you wanted to imagine what did the seas look like, what did the life look like, here's a picture. It would have been dominated by these long-shelled nautiloids that sometimes got 20 feet long. So imagine an ice cream cone 20 feet long, about this big around, with the thing coming out of it looking kind of like a squid or an octopus with a beak about this big. And these guys would have been the terrors of the sea of the Ordovician. This is before you really get into the more advanced fishes. There are what we call the jawless fishes, which are about this big. They have bony coverings on the outside, but they don't actually have jaws. They have like a little ring for a mouth. Really primitive stuff. This is the time of invertebrates, okay? And so this leaves behind some of the best fossils in the world for that period of time, especially the trilobites, which, by the way, Isatelus gigas is our state fossil. And the actual Isatelus gigas down at, I think, Caesar's Creek is about this big. So really neat. But trilobites galore down that area, things called crinoids, which are related to starfish, beautiful critters once they're prepped out of the sediments, just amazing diversity of life and things that we don't see today. Horn corals, people find those and always ask me, is this a dinosaur tooth? No, that's a coral. It's just a, like an ice cream cone coral, if you want to think of it that way. Brachiopods, which a lot of you don't know what it is, or maybe you've collected some of that stuff. That's very common. Not so common are clams and mussels and things like that. Some of those bivalve mollusks exist, but brachiopods, which are much more worm-like on the inside, were dominant during the Paleozoic. Now we get into the Silurian. Notice where we are. We're 30 degrees below the equator. Notice how this piece here, this is going to actually suture itself up to the rest of North America and start building the Appalachian Mountains. Okay? We're going to get a lot of those sediments that are going to be shed eventually to this area. So, what did the Silurian seas look like? Again, lots of invertebrates, but this time we have these giant sea scorpions called Eurypterids. Some of these are 6 to 10 feet long. So imagine a sea scorpion, call it a sea scorpion. It's not quite a scorpion, but it kind of looks like one. Imagine going in your basement and seeing a 3-footer of one of those, right? I mean, you know, you'd have to get some pretty big boots out to stomp on that thing. That was probably the apex predator of the day, okay? But you notice that we are starting to get more fish varieties. Okay, so the jawed fish are now around. The first chondrichthyans, sharks and their relatives, come about. Probably even going back to the very early Silurian. And the first relatives of the tetrapods, the four-legged things that we see today, the vertebrates, those relatives are starting to come around as well as the regular bony fish. Again, fossil-wise, beautiful fossils, good trilobite varieties, really weird echinoderms. I mean, these things all had stalks on them and had little arms that came out of the top and they filter fed, okay? Unfortunately, and I'll get to this, in our area, we're never gonna see that type of preservation. If we go into Indiana and down into Kentucky, we will see that kind of preservation. But it has to do with, and I'll get into this, what the seas were like during the Silurian in this area. And again, just to show you some more of the variety, these are the crinoids, very sought after by collectors, going for sometimes tens of thousands of dollars, okay? And again, our brachiopods, and this snail is pretty interesting. Every time we find that snail, it's usually on top of one of these crinoids, and actually it, how can I put it? It's a poop eater. Okay, so that's its niche. It sits on top and it takes the waste from the crinoid, and that's how it lived. So nothing goes to waste in nature. Okay, now we get into the late Devonian. Notice where we are now. We're above 30 degrees, and notice that the seas are starting to shrink back. The Appalachians are starting to build. Look what's coming up from the south, though. Okay, this is going to be Africa and parts of South America are going to collide with what we call Laurentia or Laurasia eventually. This is our part of North America. We're kind of connected to Asia. And so these two big pieces are going to come together. Sometimes the Devonian is called the Age of Fishes because at this point, there are so many different weird types of fish, stuff that's extinct today, okay? Things that you can't even imagine. What I'm calling sharks are really chondrichthyans. They've got big spines coming out, brush complexes, whorls of teeth coming out of their mouth, right? The placoderms, they're still around, Dunkleosteids and some of those really gigantic, big-headed fish that look like guillotine mouthpieces, right? Just bizarre stuff. I know someone once told me, imagine you're in a boat fishing in the Lake Devonian. Every time you caught something, you'd scream like bloody murder because it'd be so scary, right? But by the time you get into the Mississippi in the next period, you'd be like, yeah, it's weird looking, but I recognize that. You wouldn't be like at the end of the boat screaming or anything like that. So this is a weird time. Again, nice trilobites. These all come from the silica shale up in Paulding County. Okay, that's up. Has anybody ever hunted the silica shale in Paulding County or north into Toledo? They have parks that you can go into, and occasionally the quarries will let you in. So they used to let you in a lot more, but yeah, because of liability and everything, they're kind of sticky on that. Again, we have our crinoids. And what's really neat is some of these brachiopods are about this big, and they've been turned to pyrite. So they're kind of golden in color. This is Dunkleostees. This was found around the Cleveland area. This thing's about 10 to 15 feet long. It's covered in those hard bones. Notice that the mouth is kind of like a guillotine. So this would have been swimming in those seas, but it wouldn't have been as flexible as, say, the early relatives of the sharks or the bony fish. Okay, this is actually one of the very primitive sharks that was found in Cleveland. In fact, we prepped one of those out in my lab and wrote a paper that went out several years ago about that and kind of dispelled some of the myths about those early shark-like things. So Cleveland has one of the best assortments of those Devonian fishes. Bet you guys didn't know that, right? So our state has some of the best fossils in the world. All right, so that's pretty cool. Now we get into what's called the Mississippian. The Mississippian, and above it is the Pennsylvanian. In Europe, they call it the Carboniferous because at this point, there's huge swamps all over the place. Okay, sea levels are high, but they come and they recede. They come and they recede because at that point, the Earth is in one of its ice ages. And so as the ice grows, the sea levels drop and these swamps grow, these huge swamps. And then those swamps die, they grow, they die, and they lay all the stuff that becomes peat and eventually coal, okay? So you can see at this point, we're still underwater, but there's the mountains. And so sometimes, even though our portion of Ohio is underwater, the eastern portion was not. Okay, I think you can see that the fish are starting to look a little bit more familiar. This is a shark, Chondrichthyan. Shark is a colloquial term, unfortunately. But yeah, and that is too. And there's a bony fish, and there's some bony fish. And they kind of look like something we'd see today. I mean, we wouldn't be screaming, like I told you, so. Fossils, you really have to go to the mid of the state to get to the Mississippian fossils in Ohio. But we do have some decent fossils up around, like from Columbus north, getting toward the Appalachian Plateau are good areas to actually collect. Now we're in the Pennsylvanian, and notice now we are above sea level. And again, now this is a time of swamps again to the east. All right, our portion of Ohio doesn't really have any sediments from the Pennsylvanian, but all we have to do is go northwest and we can get into them again, into the coal fields. And so what did those seas look like? Well, the seas were, again, interesting. Still a lot of invertebrates. But notice all the types of sharks and fishes. And what's really interesting is if we go out east to around like the Athens area, the Pennsylvanian is really well exposed. And that was a real swampy area. So you can actually get into spots where you can find sharks that lived in like these restricted little ponds and lakes. But you can also find the remains of cockroaches about this big and dragonflies with wings like that and really cool looking swampy plants, and that's all exposed all on the eastern part of Ohio. So just to show you, this is some of the fossils that you'll find in Ohio in the Pennsylvanian. That is a shark tooth called Petalotus. This is the root. That's the part that comes above the mouth. And this is an embolomere, a big amphibian about this big. And so now we actually got things that are walking on land that are vertebrates. Notice all the little teeth. Actually kind of a nasty little guy. I found a jaw of one in some of the limestones out in eastern Ohio that's really not supposed to be there, so that's gonna be a paper, so that's pretty cool. Unfortunately, a lot of work hasn't been focused on Ohio in the last
say 50 or so years, everybody's interested in going to South America, Africa, and Asia, but it leaves everything here undocumented, and we need plenty of workers in North America to actually uncover geologic past. One of the things you will find too are incredible plant preservation, and these are all Pennsylvanian plants. These are non-flowering plants. Flowers are not going to come around for a long, long time after this. So, and then finally we get into the early Permian, and you can barely see that little circle, but the Appalachians are fully built now. This is Africa. This is North America. Up here is Asia. Down here is South America. And only in the very eastern part of Ohio, which was swampy enough to preserve fossil remains, is where we actually have some fossils from the Permian. Okay, so at that point, we have these mammal-like reptiles, like Dimetrodon, that are living in the area. We have these bizarre-looking sharks that are living in the lakes. And how do we know that? Because we have tracks and trails of those mammal-like reptiles. We actually have fossil remains. And of course, we have plants. All right, that's an overview of our state through time. Sorry it took so long, but hopefully it was kind of interesting. Now, back to the Silurian of West Central Ohio. Notice that in North America, these are the only Silurian outcrops. And where's the biggest one? Indiana and Ohio. And what's really interesting about this is here you can see all the Silurian strata surrounding us in the lake, right? These became big restricted seas. You got to imagine these reefs that formed around this area would be like the Great Barrier Reefs. And these seas would be disconnected from the other ocean. And over time, these seas would get saltier and saltier. And eventually, the minerals would start to work their way into the limestone and turn the limestone into what we call dolostone or dolomite. So where we live in Ohio, everything is dolomitic in the Silurian. And I mean, we mine this stuff all the time. There are quarries everywhere, okay? Why do we mine it? Well, first, it can be produced into aggregate for concrete. Secondly, it can be dimensional stone for building. It's very pretty, some of it, when you slice it. There's primarily the reason. Sometimes you're actually going to clear some of the Silurian out of the way to get a little bit deeper, but that's not that usual. But a lot of times it's also used for road fill and driveways. And if you have a stone driveway with the like whitish gray stone, that's dolomite. And dolomite reacts with acid, but very slowly. So the stuff lasts forever, right? So good building stone. So here's the system of reefs that are existing here in Indiana and Ohio. So this is a restricted area and an evaporite basin. And a lot of people don't realize this, but underneath Michigan, particularly around that southern part, like Detroit and all, is a huge salt dome, okay, from this evaporating seas that left their salts behind. The salt dome is so big that, I mean, imagine having a Tupperware bowl about this big, right? And then a little pencil eraser sitting on the top. That'd be Detroit, and that'd be the salt dome. That's how big it is. And a lot of the salt that we use comes from that area. So this is all from those restricted seas and reefs that formed during the Silurian. Now, these are our particular fossils from the area. Notice that they don't have the outer covering like we saw before. That's because as the limestone turned to dolomite, the very outer part of the fossil is lost. But the actual shape of the fossil, the exterior of the fossil, is very well preserved in the rock. So when you hit the rock and you break it open, sometimes a natural cast will pop on out. And other times you can take what's left, what we call the mold. And for us, these are actually plates from a paper we just published last year. You can pour silicone in there, pop it out, and you've got a complete replica of what the fossil looked like. So we've got an incredible diversity of invertebrates here, but a lot of people are like, it's all dolomite, who wants that? Well, actually, they're very pretty, and they're scientifically very important, and we got a really large paper out of it. So that was Ohio State and Wright State Lake put out a paper, finally. I've been here 23 years and swore we were going to get one out, so we finally did. I'm not just a shark worker. I
primarily, but anything interesting I'll work on, so it doesn't matter. Okay, where do you see the Silurian stuff? Well, this is Poppleman's Quarry on the border of Dark and Miami counties. This is a very vast tract of Silurian, but you don't have to go down there to see it. You can go to Stone Co. up the road, and you can see the reefs there too. That is Stone Co. And here you can actually see those color bands. That's part of the reef that formed during the Silurian. And a lot of those fossils that you see came out of both of these quarries that I showed you before. Okay, any questions so far? I say that to my class, I look, and sometimes I have to make sure they're all still breathing. And
why don't we find more gold, why don't we have the gold,
You need to have the hard rock for gold, the igneous and metamorphic rock. We're really more into the sedimentary rocks here. Yeah, it's the type of rock that doesn't usually accumulate the metals and stuff. Although sometimes, and I'll show you, you know, the glaciers brought down rocks from that craton area that's exposed at the top, and that's pretty cool. All right, so let's move ahead 400 million years. See, we have to zoom ahead here. This is crazy. But you know how we say we're living in a time of a warming climate, and you hear, I won't be controversial, but you hear people saying, like, the warmest temperature ever was recorded last summer. I don't know where they get that from. If we go back into the Eocene, this is about 50 million years ago, the Earth is in one of its hottest times ever. I doubt that there's any ice anywhere on Earth. I mean, it's so hot that in England, it has an African fauna. There are crocodiles living in Montana. All right, it's hot. And we get to this maximum, and then very quickly, the Earth starts to cool again. So the Earth has gone through many ice ages in its history. We know about three periods, what we call them ice houses, and we're in one now. And you notice that around 40 or so million years ago, the temperatures start to really fall and then continue to drop until we get to where we are today. So today we're actually in a pretty cold regime. Why did that happen? Well, around 50 to 40 million years ago, this piece of land we call India was coming up from where Australia is today and collided with Asia. And it's continuing to collide. In fact, India is actually going underneath Asia, and that collision has brought up the Himalayas. And so those mountains continue to rise, and below, and you know, north of those mountains is the Tibetan Plateau, and this is a very, very big region of elevation. And as those rocks go up, they erode very quickly. And as rocks erode quickly, and here we're talking about the hard rocks, the igneous rocks like granites and things, it pulls the carbon dioxide right out of the air. And so it combines with that and actually forms limestones in the sea. So what's been going on, as those mountains have been rising, the CO2 levels have been dropping, and the Earth has been cooling. No matter what we do today, in 2 million years, this Earth is going to be back into a big-time glaciation ice age, no matter what we do. And I'm a historical geologist, so we don't look at 1,000 years, we don't look at 10,000 years, we look at 100,000 years, million years. Climate is always changing. It's never stable, okay? We'd like to think it is, but it's never stable. So right now, we're living in a time of a little bit of climate change. Part of that is natural. Part of it is probably man-made. It's hard to divorce the pieces together. And what's going to happen is anybody's guess. So over the last 500,000 years, you can see we've had cold, warm, cold, warm, cold, warm. Every time it's cold, we have glaciers building. Every time it's warm, the glaciers melt back. Right now, we're past that glacial stage. We're getting past that glacial stage. So the glaciers are actually starting to melt back. We're in, you know, a post-glacial part of the ice age. We're still in the ice age, but we're in a post-glacial part of the ice age, which could start glaciating at any time. It doesn't take much to trigger this, okay? Here, I'm actually showing you carbon dioxide laid on top of the temperature variation. Notice when carbon dioxide levels are high, temperatures are high.
when carbon dioxide levels fall, temperatures fall. But every time the carbon dioxide peaks, it falls rapidly. There's where we are right now. So we're due for a fall. Now, we may have been going into that fall way back during the Little Ice Age. And then the Industrial Revolution came around and started putting carbon dioxide into the air. Maybe we've prevented the glaciers from covering Ohio and North America. I don't know. It's an interesting thing. All right, a little bit about glaciers, right? We all talk about glaciers. What is a glacier? Where do they form? They have to form on land. They do not form on water. Okay, when you get ice on water, that's sea ice. As the glacier moves off the land and into the water, it calves. It breaks off pieces, and these are called icebergs. In any glacier, there's a part where the glacier is accumulating and a part where it's melting back. And if everything is in equilibrium, this front here will stay stationary. But even if it stays stationary, the ice is continually moving down below, grinding away the land and bringing all that rock and stuff right to the very front. And so if the glacier starts to melt back, all that rock and stuff remains, and the next front forms. And then that melts back, and that part remains. And you get a system of ridges, okay? We call these eskers, and we call them moraines. And so there's all different types of moraines, and these moraines are the ground up rock from the glaciers moving. There are what we call lateral moraines, there are what we call end moraines, and there are what we call terminal moraines. And you can see these moraines where we live in Ohio, if you're real careful. I know we've plowed a lot of stuff down for farming, but the topography still exists, okay? So just to show you the max on the ice, this is the Laurentide ice sheet. There have been about four pulses of glaciation that have occurred in Ohio and in North America on land. About 18 that we see in the sea. But on land, because every time a new set of glaciers comes down, it kind of rubs away the remains of the last glacier that left stuff behind. So we have to be very careful looking for it. But I can tell you that, I think they say maybe the ice coverage in this part of Ohio and north may be almost a mile deep at the maximum. And that wasn't that long ago. Say 15,000 years ago? Pretty amazing, right? So you guys have heard about the Taze River. Well, it seems like the Taze River is maybe one of the most ancestral, oldest rivers in the world. And it was a vast river, okay? And you notice it started in North Carolina and flowed in what is today Illinois down into Missouri. But as the glaciers came and started to cover up those river valleys, right, with till, that stuff that's left behind, the river changed its course, and today we call it the Ohio, right? The Taze is gone, but the gorge, the river valley, is left behind, and it's buried under all that sediment from the glaciers, okay? So you can see that, you know, where this river once flowed, it's left behind aquifers and stuff, right? So like in St. Mary's, we use the Taze River as our water source. We can't use that here in Mercer County because, well, we drilled oil wells and it kind of contaminated that aquifer. So we can't really use that here. But that would have been a huge, huge river system until it got subdiverted and became the Ohio. I mean, this is what the Taze River would have looked like about 2 million years ago. And this has been running right through our backyard. No kidding. Huge river valleys, all kinds of lush plants, ice age animals and stuff. And then the glaciers came down and changed the course of the Taze River. And this is probably what it would have looked like if you were like living out here and you looked out your back window and saw that. So it wasn't really good. But as that glacier came down, it actually dammed up the Taze first, and this became something called Lake Tite. And Lake Tite was 900 feet deep, and it was huge. Over like from, you know that circle I showed you, that orange circle? Imagine making that even bigger, and that would have been Lake Tite. And it was huge, and it got dammed up. As the glaciers started to melt back, Lake Tite released all of its water, And that helped change the course of the Taze as well. So, today, because of ground penetrating radar and other studies, we've actually seen what's left of that old Taze River Valley, and it runs, look where it runs, right by New Knoxville, right by Bodkins, all the way down, and it's very, very deep, and it's full of sediments. And guess what? It also lays right on top of the Grenville fault line. Imagine that. Rivers love to flow along fault lines. And now you've got towns actually laying on top of till hundreds of feet thick. So when there's an earthquake, you really feel it because the ground is soft. This just gives you what they think the cross section actually looks like. That is a river gorge. Okay? And so when the glaciers melted, the debris and what we call till, the remains of the rocks, the sand, the sediments, the boulders, all start to fill the old Taze River Valley and simply diverted its flow. And this just shows you what the Pleistocene glaciation looked like. Now, in Europe, most of Europe and Northern Asia was covered. I'm not so sure about the Southern Hemisphere. There's not as much land as you get to those higher latitudes. But Antarctica is fully, you know, covered in ice at this point. One thing that's interesting, people think like the whole country or a whole, you know, continent was cold, right? I can tell you this. If you were living in Florida during the Ice Age, you would have had warm days. It would probably be more like it is, say, in Virginia today instead of being really, really hot, right? It's been, yeah, kind of temperate. Out to the west, we actually have a change in climate. What today is a lot of desert actually had big lakes. The remains of one is the Great Salt Lake. So as the climate changed, right, it became drier and drier in the west. Go figure. It's all desert out there. And they're always worried about, you know, the rainfall. But they are living in a desert, and so it's dry. So I don't know what to say. People ask me questions. I don't know. I mean, I can tell you that in the 1800s, when everybody moved west, it was a wetter period of time. And everybody's like, hey, this is great. Look at all the crops we can grow, and there's water. And then yeah, that was just a couple of decades. And then whoop, back into the desert. So, okay, so Ohio. Yes, we had quite an interesting fauna here. Mammoths, mastodons, giant beavers, giant bears. You know, glyptodonts, these things that look like little Volkswagen bugs covered in like bony scutes all over. Giant armadillos, giant sloths, really cool stuff. And yes, we can find some of those remains. And I don't have a whole lot of pictures here, but these are just some of the remains that come from Ohio. There's a cave bear skull, a mammoth tooth, giant beaver, mastodon tooth. These are fairly common to find in the fields and the creeks. So. All right, so as the glaciers melted back, first off, you got to remember, all that ice depressed the land down, okay? So as the ice melts back, it takes a long time for the land to rebound up. So we're kind of living in a low area. Plus, all that till filled in, so that sandy, kind of loose, blue clay soil that we have, that started to fill in. Very poor drainage, and so we also had what's called Lake Maumee, which is the ancestral Lake Erie, which was much, much larger. And as all that started to kind of retreat back, we were left with the area we call the Great Black Swamp. And I'm not a historian, but I can tell you from what I've seen on PBS and some other stuff and what I've read, it took quite a while to build roads from this area up to, towards Toledo. They actually had to make them out of logs at first because that mud was so sticky. And so this was a gigantic swampy area. And this was a swampy area right here. And as you saw on the map that was presented before, you could see the watersheds all draining into this lake. And so this was a natural area to form a lake. It wasn't a lake at the time until they dammed up the rivers, changed the course, kind of made the basin, took out the trees. But it's semi-natural. It's a swamp basin. Okay? So you can feel good about that when you say it's man-made. Yes, it is man-made, but it's also kind of semi-natural. That's pretty neat. So you got both. Who can argue with that, right? This map shows you the thickness of that remains of the glaciers. This is called a till map, and it shows you that where we live, the till's pretty thick. And that is the stuff that covers the Silurian down below. Some places it's 10 feet, some places it's 50 feet. Depends. Okay? Now let's jump to about 140 years ago. All right. So in Indiana, this is in like the 1860s. So they're actually digging for coal in parts of Indiana, right on the edge of what we call the Indiana gas field. And these miners, I don't know, you know, they're opening up these mine shafts, and all of a sudden this terrible smelling gas comes out. And they think they've actually opened up the gates of hell. This is by newspaper stuff that I read. So they sealed it up. Well, then somebody noticed it's really cool that, you know, some of these spots, if you poke down into it, the gas comes out and you can light it and you got a torch at night. Well, they're actually into the commercial or into the natural gas. And very quickly, you know, the Industrial Revolution is ramping up in the 1800s. Well, you need petroleum to fuel that revolution. And, you know, electricity is a newcomer in 1880, right? People use gas to light lamps and keep themselves, you know, at night from the darkness. And so by 1886, there was a commercial gas well established in Indiana. And around, I guess maybe about 922 feet deep is where they actually found the gas veins. Okay, and so people got what they called gas fever. Everybody wanted to dig a hole and get the natural gas out. Well, this was called the Trenton gas field at first. Today it's called the Indiana and Lima gas oil field. And it was big, about 5,000 square miles, okay? And eventually, by digging down, not only did they discover gas, but they discovered petroleum. And lots of petroleum, okay? So, by the 1880s, this had a profound impact on Ohio. We became, well, John D. Rockefeller had a hand here, but he actually invested money in northwestern Ohio. And we were the biggest producer of oil and gas in the world until they discovered the Texas oil fields in the 1880s, late 1880s. Okay, but you know, oil was still going on here. In 1891, the first oil wells were drilled in Grand Lake, St. Mary's, or Grand Lake. Wood pilings were driven down for the derricks. Okay, and then by the 1910, early 1900s, you know, even though there's still a lot of oil below our feet, a lot, it's just not economical to pull it out. So everybody moved to, say, you know, the Texas, Oklahoma oil fields. Some stuff came from Europe. And then we were left with all these derricks. And so the state Senate actually passed a bill to provide the money to remove those old derricks and wood pilings. So by 1920s, most of that stuff was removed. Okay. Now, one of the questions is, why so much oil? Well, remember I talked about the Silurian dolomite, right? And below the Silurian in time is the Ordovician. And there's vast amounts of shale and limestone that had living things in it that eventually, because of chemical changes, became petroleum products. Now, we also live on a very faulted place because of the Grenville Fault Line. Those faults and fissures crack and let the oil and petroleum go upward. And they would continue to go upward, except they run into the Silurian dolomite and they're capped. And so over time, vast oil and gas fields form below the Silurian cap. And so today, yeah, you could probably go and drill for oil here. I wouldn't do it. You know, you probably run into some problems with the EPA and the state, and you know, it's probably not a good idea. But there is still a lot of oil. All I can tell you is, as far as the Trenton limestone, I've seen it before, but you won't see it here. You have to dig too deep, right? But in the, I just spoiled my closer, man. Okay. So right here, right, this is an exposure in upstate New York of the Trenton limestone. Here's a little hand sample showing you all the invertebrate fossils. This is where they frack. When you hear fracking, they're fracking that Ordovician stuff a lot of times. And so we got natural fracking going on. Over time, it just released its petroleum and it moved itself up to the top. But that is the source of the oil here. It's about 1,000 feet below. And so that brings us to our present day. Okay, there it is. I got to give a shout out to Roddy. I think it's Rowdy Raider. No, we're Loudy. That's right. We had to come up with a name, so we came up with Loudy. I like it. It's kind of hodaggish, but a little bit different. And probably the most distinctive things I've seen as far as sea monsters go. But yeah, so that takes us right to the very end. So thank you. Any questions?
One quick one, you may have said, so how far down, as far as the oil and whatnot that would be out there, how far below the surface?
I'm thinking it's probably close to 500 to 1,000 feet, which is not crazy for a drill rig to drill down like that, you know? And I think it was estimated that at least half of the petroleum remains, maybe more. But it's not economical right now to pull it up.
Okay, I have a question about the oil too. I heard that this could not be true at all, which is why I'm asking. I heard that like the pressure field needed to like lift the oil out of the ground was like ruined. So I heard that like if you try to extract the oil, it's hard to get it out because the pressure to make it come up is gone.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, you lose the natural pressure, right? I mean, at first you've got all that natural gas in there, right? And so that helps push the oil out. You know, when they drill down and you see the derrick and the oil squirting out of the top, that's that pressure you're talking about at first. But then what they do, and I'm not an expert in petroleum geology, okay, but I believe they use salt water and pump it down into holes to push the oil out, which of course then contaminates the aquifers and the groundwater around there. But yeah, I mean, at first, you know, you always see this on a movie, right? Or TV, Landman, whatever. You know, they're digging down, they hit the oil, and it's... But that's at first, right? But the natural gas usually comes off for quite a while, so there's a lot of pressure. Usually they burn that gas off because it's not what they really want to use. So. Yeah, it just found that we could still get the oil out, but it wouldn't be economical. Any other questions? No. In fact, the Grenville province is which closed up that mid-continental rift. I mean, that's what they think, right? Because it was actually a three-part rift, and it was starting to extend northward and then to the southwest and then to the southeast, breaking, at the time, what we called Laurentia, into three pieces. And you can actually see the basalts and stuff in Iowa, but you have to like get into quarries or drill down and get into the cores. But as you know, as that piece came closer and closer and closer, it pushed in against there, and we think it stopped the rifting. But yeah, we're on the Grenville, right here.
Question.
Yeah.
Do you suggest
we
get earthquake insurance on our
homes? Andrea and I have contemplated this before. I mean, if you do get a 4 or 5, it could crack your foundation and your chimneys. And it's not unheard of to get that happening around here. So I'm kind of like on the fence with that, you know? That could be pretty expensive.
Is there a place where all this information, we can get it?
Huh.
You just gave to us? Is it in textbooks?
Well, it's in my class on historical geology. I mean, there's information out there. If you go to the Ohio Survey, the ODNR, if you go to the geologic survey part, you'll see a lot of brochures and pamphlets documenting the different ages in Ohio. It's a really good source of information. Awesome. And the geologic survey had been gutted for a while, money-wise, but now they're putting money back into it again. And so there's actually people working there, and you know, because I think they figured out that, you know, maybe geology is important after all, you know.
Yeah.
You might want to know something about, you know, the ground below your feet.
So wonder, are aquifers around here aren't contaminated with oil and whatever from all of these derricks?
They are. And so the Taze aquifer, I believe, flows from like Auglaize through Mercer, and I believe that's contaminated, that portion.
What about us with wells?
Oh, you're not deep enough.
They're not deep enough,
yeah. Aquifers are weird things, and you know, there can be several layers of aquifers, and I doubt you're going down that deep, so it's probably fine. But yeah, I mean, I think that's one reason. I don't know how capped the wells are. I think, you know, if they were closed down in 1910, 1920, they're not going to have the technology back then to really seal them up like they do today. I think a lot of them are just sedimented over. The lake sediment has actually just filled the wells. So one reason probably not to dredge too deep. So, but I think they have maps showing where all the extinct wells are. I think they've mapped most of them now. So, but you know, it costs. So you can drill for oil on your property. They do it a lot in parts of Ohio. They do it all throughout Michigan. They actually have little oil wells on people's property. But then you're responsible for, when it's done, closing them off. So the oil companies, what they'll do is sell you the deed for about a dollar or so, because it costs about $500,000 to close them off. And they don't want to pay for closing them off. So they unload them on people. And yeah, you'll make money for a little while, but eventually you've got to seal that well off, unless you can sell it to somebody else. Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah.
How many wells were drilled out here on the lake area?
I don't know. I would say probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 to 80, I would think. Judging by the pictures, it was pretty dense. So I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, you can go to the geosurvey and look up the map, and it'll show you in there. I think there's some other archives and stuff. And I'm sure Steve Jackman and all, they've looked at that to see how many of those wells lay around.
State of Ohio has a map with all the oil and gas wells around the lake.
Yeah, I think, yeah. I mean, they've tried to map them as best they can, so. All right, again, thank you all.
Thank you. Thank you. From us. Thank you, Dr. Spaglio. So the last thing we have is the 50-50, and while we're getting that drawn really quick, just want to give you a heads up. Our next meeting, a month from today, this will help answer your question, sir. We're going to have a history of oil and natural gas on the lake with Caitlin Clark, the director of the Mercer County Historical Society. Jeff, do we have a 50-50 winner? Took in $117.
No, we're going to give away 57.
Giving away 57.
Blue ticket, last three digits, 906.
Blue ticket, 906.
906.
Maybe someone who left. Well, if you check and you have 906, please come see Jeff. Other than that, thanks for coming out, and I hope you have a great weekend.